Well, good morning. This is awesome. Yeah, I feel like I should be like, go Chieftains. But normally you would be like, ah, but you didn't do that. So, or like, hey, for the rest of the day, classes are canceled. Okay. The good thing is that God shows up in gymnasiums like he does in auditoriums, like he does in church buildings, like he does in a cabin in the mountains. There's nothing, no place that God cannot enter. And so, yeah, this is really, yeah, I'm getting like flashbacks from high school of like assembly times. Anyway, really good to be with you. You guys, first of all, thank you for your support. Calvary has been in this fight with us for a long time to end the trafficking and exploitation of children. Your generosity through the years has been super encouraging. You know, there's a guy named Gary Haugen who runs an organization called the International Justice Mission, and he makes this statement all the time. He says that victims of injustice in our world do not need our spasm of passion. What they need instead is our legs and lungs of endurance and our long obedience in the same direction. And so thank you that you have gone beyond spasm of passion realm, and you've been in this and in this and in this, and there's been legs and lungs of endurance in your partnership with the work that we're doing. So I thank you for that. Those of you that are not familiar with Love 146, again, my colleague Carly is here this morning, and she'll be out, and I'll be out in the cafeteria later to answer any of your questions. But basically, we're working to end the trafficking and exploitation of children. If you're like me, I was given the impression when I was in high school that slavery ended with something that we call the Emancipation Proclamation. But the reality is that slavery still exists today in some of its worst imaginable forms, and oftentimes the victims of that form of slavery are the most vulnerable, which are children. And it's something that doesn't just happen over there in places like Eastern Europe or Southeast Asia, but it happens here as well. I don't know if you heard the news this morning, but I was driving in this morning and I had the radio on, and the news, literally the headline news today, was the discovery last night in San Antonio in a Walmart parking lot of a truck full of almost 40 victims of human trafficking. 8 of them had died in the truck because of heat exhaustion. People being trafficked, sold like commodities, kept in places like trucks as they're being transported to be sold. Horrific stuff. So this is current. This is happening, literally happening last night. And some of those victims, again, were children. And this is what we're working to end. We began in Southeast Asia 15 years ago, providing survivor care, caring for children who this has happened to. We went from Southeast Asia and expanded into the UK, and then we expanded here into the US because, again, this is something that happens here. And after doing survivor care for some time and caring for the victims of this kind of injustice, we began feeling this ache, feeling like, man, we're never going to stop this by just caring for the victims. We need to do something to prevent it. And so we created our prevention program. So we have two arms of approach of prevention as well as survivor care. And even in the state of Connecticut, we've been able to provide services to over 200 children right in our own state. Nationally, we've been able to provide prevention education to almost 20,000 kids. And so this is an ongoing work that you have invested in, that you've been a part of. So thank you for that. Oftentimes people ask, how can I get involved? What can I do to get involved? I don't know if we got the next slide here. Here's three really practical things very quickly. How many of you pray? All right. I would assume most people that show up at a gym on a Sunday morning probably pray. So if you pray, here's a really practical way to get involved is we have people all over the world that basically engage in praying for the work that we're doing. And you could do this in a really practical way. If you text the number 41 or you text the words love 146 to this number 411247, we will send you, we're not going to bombard you, but maybe once a month, sometimes twice a month, we'll send you a prayer request. Oftentimes they're urgent prayer requests. Something is happening right now that we need you and our prayer warriors to begin praying for. Sometimes it'll be a celebratory type text saying thank you for your prayers, this is what just happened. And so it's a way to stay closer and involved, and we really look at those that pray as being crucial in this fight. Another way that you can get involved is by giving. Our monthly sponsors, you can find out more about this at the table. They're the lifeblood of our organization. We're able to strategize and know where we're going and how we're going to get there because we know what's coming in. So if you want to become a monthly sponsor of our work, we would appreciate that as well. Or if you want to become part of a volunteer team, the great thing is out of Calvary, there's been birthed a volunteer team. So there are people right here, sitting right here, that are involved in that. If you want to be involved more hands-on and get your fingers dirty into the issue right here in Hartford and in our state, and get involved in more practical ways, you can become part of a volunteer team that meets on a regular basis, and we can talk about that afterwards. So those are practical ways that you can get involved. So this morning, I want to talk about hope. And if you're like me, there's been this like growing angst of hopelessness that seems to be happening all around us. I had an encounter last year. I was celebrating my 54th birthday with a friend of mine who is a year older than me, but we have the same birthdays. And we were at a restaurant, and we were sitting there, and we're celebrating our birthday. And in a short period of time, we started talking. I was sharing, and he was sharing different things, physical ailments that we find happening in our lives. And I was talking about how, you know, that, man, I've got to wear reading glasses now when I'm at a restaurant to be able to read what's on the menu. And the next thing I was talking about was how I've lost most of the hearing in my right ear. I played in a band for years when I was growing up. Through my teen years, and I had, back then, we didn't have these fancy, like, in-ear monitors. We just had blasting monitors that were blasting sound in my ears. You know, I remember my parents during that time saying, you're going to go deaf by the time you're 40 years old and everything. I'm like, all right, yeah, Mom, whatever. Well, it's true. Those of you that are young people and everything, and your parents are like, man, you got those earbuds in your ears blasting. I can hear the music from here. You're going to go deaf. You will. Listen to your mom and dad. I'm now deaf in this ear. It's always embarrassing when I'm with people, and I have to make sure that I'm listening with this ear, because if you're on this side, I'm not ignoring you. I just don't hear you. And so I was talking about that. I'm losing my hearing, my sight. And then we just started laughing as we discovered, man, where are those guys now? We're like talking about our ailments and how we're like our bodies are breaking down and everything. And then at the same time, I look at him and I say, you know what, though? Something else is happening to me. Internally, something is happening in me that has caught my attention, and that hope, like never before, has been rising in me. And I'm not sure why that is, because everything around me, all outward circumstances, should be saying the opposite, even through the work that I do. It should be saying that, man, if anything, hope should be diminishing and diminishing. But through what looks like growing despair and cynicism and hopelessness, the opposite is happening to me. There's this hope that is rising in me like I've never experienced before. And I'm like, what is that? And so I've been on this journey to try to discover, what is that? Man, if I could figure it out and I could put it in a book form, who knows what can make a lot of money off of selling hope. But that's not, as we know, how it works. But I've begun to pay attention to what is it that's causing hope to rise in me, and I wanted to share some of that with you this morning. And we find in the work that we do at Love 146, there are two forms of hope that we deal with on a daily basis. One is what we call a hope deferred. The thing that you long for, the thing that you hope to see happen, the thing that you're aching for, the result that you long for isn't happening. Our vision as an organization is the end of child trafficking and exploitation. We haven't seen the end of it. And when you see the news and you see the numbers and the statistics, it feels like you're never going to see it. And many people deal with these kinds of issues. Those that have fought for decades upon decades in the civil rights movement will tell you the same thing, that it hasn't happened yet. And so there's this longing and there's this ache, and it's a hope that's put off. There's a hope that seems to be postponed. And we deal with this on a daily basis. But the other form of hope that we also deal with is what I call a defiant hope. Hope defiant, that actually isn't a passive kind of hope, but it's an aggressive kind of hope that actually pushes against despair and that hope deferred. And so I want to talk about both of those forms of hope this morning. In Psalm 40, verse 1, it says this, I love this, that the psalmist wrote this, I waited and waited and waited for God. I love this passage, because can you feel the ache here? I mean, he could have easily just written, I waited for God. But he doesn't. He says, I waited, and I waited, And I waited. There's an excruciation kind of thing happening here that, man, I'm longing, I'm aching, I'm waiting. How many of you can identify with this kind of hope deferred where you feel like, man, I'm waiting? Maybe it's for healing. Maybe it's for a friend who's going through something. Maybe it's something in your own, whatever it looks like. Or maybe it's just waiting for the kingdom of God to come. And it's just, I waited and waited. And I said, I love that he said it three times because you could feel it. You could feel that longing. You could feel that ache, and many of us can relate to that. How long, God? How long is it going to take? How long? I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. That's what we're talking about when we say a hope deferred. Proverbs 13:12 says this, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled is a tree of life. Oftentimes, the word deferred there means postponed or put off. Oftentimes, when we're living in that place of a hope deferred and we're waiting and waiting, during that waiting period, oftentimes we become heartsick. Our heart begins to break because we're not seeing the thing that we long for come to pass. And there's a heart sickness that begins to develop. We've experienced this even in my own family, in that we have 6 kids, soon to be 7 kids, our 4 youngest, soon to be 5 youngest, we have adopted. And any of you that have been in the adoption process know that oftentimes most of that process is a waiting and waiting. It's filling out paperwork and waiting and waiting, and there's this longing. And we have had to deal with this hope deferred that we think it's going to happen and then it doesn't happen. Or the thing is almost within grasp and it seems to be taking away, and there is a heart sickness that is developed. We've been in the process right now. Our youngest daughter that we adopted 8 years ago, we adopted from Vietnam, and we were in that process for over 2 years waiting to bring her into our family, to bring her home. She finally came home, and at that time we said, man, we want to do this again. We want to adopt another child from Vietnam, and then right at that time, the U.S. State Department closed down adoptions for U.S. citizens to adopt from Vietnam because of unethical adoptions that were actually fueling the trafficking and exploitation of children. It was crazy how my worlds were starting to get mixed up. And so they put everything on hold. Americans were not allowed to adopt from Vietnam until Vietnam became a Hague-compliant country where there were things that were put in place that would require more ethical procedures. And then finally, a little over 2 years ago, Vietnam became Hague compliant, adoptions opened up again, and we began the process. So we've been waiting year after year after year, longing for this thing to open. Opened up, we began pursuing an adoption again 2 years ago. We're right towards the end of that process right now. I want to introduce you. This is our soon-to-be daughter. Her name is Thai Minh, and she's in Vietnam right now in an orphanage. She's been there since birth. She's 7 years old. She'll be 8 years old next February. And so my wife and I have been dealing with this longing, this hope deferred thing and everything. And then we had this aha moment some time ago as we started thinking about what does hope deferred feel like for her? And you see, in the adoption world, there's a terminology, a category of children that we call waiting children. And they're waiting children simply because they've been waiting for a long time for a family of their own. And they've been in the system for a long time. We see it in our foster care system here in the United States. Kids that have been stuck in a foster care system for so long and are waiting and waiting and waiting for a family that they can call their own. A place actually called home that's a permanent place where they can reside. And man, we started thinking about what kind of ache is that? What kind of longing must there be in that place? And oftentimes a child becomes a waiting child and they enter into that category because of two reasons they become a waiting child. Oftentimes because they're an older child and there aren't a lot of people in line to adopt older children, or they're a child with disabilities because there aren't a lot of people in line adopting children with disabilities or special needs. And Thai Minh checks both of those boxes in that she's considered an older child and that she's over 3 and she has Down syndrome, and so she has a special need or a disability. So she has watched other children that she's grown up with, people come and families come and they become part of a family, and she has remained there and remained there. And I think, man, there, I wonder if she's had to deal with that heart sickness of a hope deferred and a longing for something to come to pass, and it doesn't come to pass. That's what the Bible is talking about, that a hope deferred makes the heart sick. I think about the children that we work with in Love 146, and oftentimes they're longing for justice, to see justice happen for them, to see the perpetrators who've committed horrendous crimes against them arrested and prosecuted and sent to prison. Oftentimes that doesn't happen. And there's a hope deferred. In fact, one of the children in our care in the Philippines, she described it as, I feel like there's a thorn in my heart that's always there because this person that did these things to me and other children is still out there free. And the day that her perpetrator was arrested and prosecuted, she said, it was like somebody pulled that thorn out of my heart finally. Hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled becomes a tree of life. And we had two children that were brought into our care almost 5 years ago now, and they waited for the perpetrator who committed horrific crimes against them and other children to be found. And through a horrendous set of circumstances, we were unable to find, and authorities were unable to identify who their perpetrator was. And so they walked through, and you could even see their countenance, this hope deferred, this person is still out there, the fear that that created for them and the thought of other children that might be harmed by this person. And then last year, their perpetrator was finally found, arrested, and sentenced to 20 years in prison. And you could see the countenance change from a hope deferred and a heart sickness to a tree of life as justice finally happened. That's the hope deferred thing. It's a longing that is not fulfilled. And so I've been on this quest. How do you keep hope alive? How do we keep our hearts from getting sick in that waiting period? And when I think about what's happening in the world today, and you guys know it, right? I mean, we're inundated with 24/7 news of the horrors that are happening all around us. We have things happening within the context of our own towns, our cities, our own nation, even our own families. We're seeing what looks like the news of increasing violence and increasing terrorism, increasing racism, and our political systems just seem so crazy. And there's this, what looks like this growing storm that's just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And I don't think it's necessarily getting worse. I think that now we have 24/7 access to the news of it all. It's been happening for a long, long time, but now it's in our faces all the time. We now have access to that information as it's happening immediately through every possible social media source and news source. And so we're inundated with the news. But it feels like this storm. And so I've been looking at this, and how do we stop our hearts from becoming sick in the midst of the storm? And so when I think about the storm thing, one of the visuals that come into my mind is stories that my grandfather used to tell me. I saw a picture last year that my dad has of my grandfather. And my grandfather went to sea when he was 18 years of age, and he spent most of his life on ships sailing the seas, and he was a mariner, and he was like the classic Hemingway old man in the sea. I was absolutely captured by my grandfather's stories. One of my greatest joys when I was growing up was sitting at my grandfather's feet and listening to him tell the stories of his days at sea, and they were amazing. But the stories that really captured me were his stories of storms at sea. And I remember one particular story that he would tell where he said that the storm was so intense and the ship looked like it was going down that his shipmates had to actually tie him to a post so he could see. He was the guy steering the ship through the storm, and he said they had to tie me to a post because the waves were crashing over the ship and would have swept me overboard. And so that I could still stay solid and steer, I was tied to a post trying to, and I remember as a kid just like, you're awesome, and thinking this is just amazing, these stories of storms at sea. And so I started looking into my history and everything, and it turns out that many of the people on my father's side of the family were mariners. In fact, there's a little tiny fishing village in Nova Scotia called Advocate Harbor. And I remember going to a cemetery there, and almost everyone in the cemetery, all the tombstones in the cemetery are Morrises. And there's like Captain William Morris, First Mate John Morris. And I always had this sort of like pride, like, I come from the sea, you know. I don't, but I had this sort of like, wow, I've got these roots that go back to these mariners, these, you know, raging through storms at sea, and I've been fascinated. So I've read the stories. I love books like Moby Dick and Shackleton's Voyages, and I've really been captured by that sense of what does it take to navigate through storms. And in my research and in my learning about the sea, I found a fascinating character that existed back in ancient Greece. And you know, when you have on a ship, you have different positions and titles of people. You have the captain, you have a navigator, you have a cook, you have the first mate, you have all of these different people. Well, in ancient Greece, there was a kind of mariner called an archegos. And the archegos on a ship in ancient Greece, his role on the ship, he was the strongest swimmer of the crew. And he was an Archegos, and what his role was that if the ship was caught in a storm but could see land but wasn't able to get to land because of the treacherous rocks and the way into the land, the ship would try to anchor offshore, and in the midst of the storm, it became the Archegos's job to create a lifeline for the people on the ship to save themselves. So the Archegos would be called up, and he would stand on the bow of the ship, and literally the rest of the people are cowering under the decks of the ship waiting to be killed, because what will happen is the ship in a storm anchored is going to get beat to pieces on the rocks, and they realize we're going to die here. And so the last hope was the Archegos. He would get up, and they would tie a rope around his waist and tie the other end of the rope around a piece of the ship, and he would dive into the insanity of the stormy ocean. And he would swim like crazy to try to get to shore, having his own body beaten against the rocks by the waves and everything. He'd finally make it to shore, and when he did, he would take the rope off himself and tie it to a rock or a tree, which created a lifeline for the cowering crew who were hiding under the decks waiting to die to make it safely to land. They would be able to pull themselves through the raging storm and the waters because the Archegos went before them. And this guy has just captured me. Can you imagine the courage it would take to be the Archegos on a ship? That when everybody else is hiding under the decks of the ship, this guy would get up and he would not only face the storm that everybody else was terrified of, he would dive into it. And he would swim like crazy, knowing that the only way that anyone here is going to survive is up to me. And he would make it to safety, creating that lifeline of hope. In fact, the word Archegos in the Greek literally means trailblazer, pioneer, sometimes even translated as author or captain. That was his job. I think it was way beyond just being a person of courage, but there is a sense of defiant hope in the Archegos, right? That he actually defied the thing that was scaring everybody else. He didn't just like stand against it and stand his ground. He actually went toward it and immersed himself into it. That's a picture to me of defiant hope. So when I think about the growing cynicism that I see around me and the growing despair, and you guys, this isn't just people who are not people of faith. I see it in the church. I meet people all the time that are losing faith. That I meet people all the time that are terrified and are being motivated by fear. And you guys, there's a lot of people out there that are peddling fear right now. There are a lot of people, leaders, that peddle fear. I don't know about you, but I'm not buying it. We just sang this morning a worship song about where our hope lies. That everything is sinking sand. In fact, I had a person some time ago, about a year and a half ago, they said, man, to be, and this was a person of faith, they said, man, to be hopeful anymore is just foolishness. And I'm like, no, I think it's an act of defiance. First of all, you said that to the wrong person, man. I think to be hopeful now is an act of defiance, not just standing passively. Sometimes we mistake optimism for hope. I'm not an optimist. People that meet me sometimes say, man, you're the most optimistic. No, I'm not. I'm not an optimist at all. I see the harshness of the reality of injustice and craziness every single day. I'm not an optimist. Optimism sometimes has a tendency to live in denial. Hey, it's all going to work out. Everything's going to be okay. No. Defiant hope recognizes the harshness of the reality, but then insists on changing it, insists on pushing against it. It's what the civil rights movement was about. There were those that didn't give in. There were those that didn't just stand, but they were like, we're going to go against the despair. We're going to actually move against it, insisting on changing it, and we still see that happening now. That's, man, if there's anybody on the planet that should be a people of defiant hope, it should be us. It should be people of faith. Defiant hope. Instead, man, sometimes it's sort of like, remember the story was a Chicken Little? The sky is falling, the sky is falling. I mean, believers who are walking around with that sort of like, the sky is falling mentality. So how do we learn this, especially in the work that we do, especially with the time that we're living? How do we become those archegoses of hope, trailblazers and pioneers of hope? Here are some quick things that I think have been helpful and that I'm still learning. I'm still in this process of learning. I'm not like an expert giving you, okay, here's the step one, step two, step three, boom, you're an archegos of hope. But these are some things that are helping me. First of all, I think for myself, I sort of have a genetic disposition to being a person of divine hope. And what I mean by that is back in 1960, my parents gave birth to their first child. And then in 1961, they wanted to have another child, but they were debating on whether they should do that or not because of the times that they were living in. Isn't it interesting that every generation looks at, like, this is it, man, with it's the end of the world, the apocalypse is right around the corner. Well, in 1961, we were living in a time called the Cuban Missile Crisis, where literally missiles were pointed at America, and it was during President Kennedy's time, and it was like, this is it. In fact, President Kennedy issued a statement, you could see it, you could Google this, encouraging Americans to invest and buy bomb shelters. Because it's going to get bad, people. So if you've got some extra money, it might not be a bad idea. In fact, you could buy, in 1961, a bomb shelter from the Sears Roebuck catalog. How many of you remember the Sears Roebuck catalog? I remember it because of Christmas time. It was, they had the Wish Book cat version where you could pick out your toys. Well, man, in you could buy a bomb shelter in Sears. And so my parents were in this really hard place. They did not have a lot of money. And so we're like, man, we have limited resources. Should we have a child which is going to require resources, another child, or should we invest in a bomb shelter? You know, the thought also was like, do we actually really want to bring another child into the insanity and madness of this world and what is becoming? I know people now, I've actually talked to people who actually express those exact same fears. Do I want to bring a child into this mess? I don't know what it's going to look like here with what looks like, you know, climate change and increasing this, oh my gosh, do I really want to do this? And those same fears my parents were dealing with. So thank God that my parents, when they were debating over child bomb shelter, they gave into defiant hope instead of giving into fear. They chose to go in the direction of being people of hope, and they conceived and gave birth to their second child, who became me. I would not be here if my parents gave into fear instead of being people of defiant hope. So I feel like defiant hope is even genetically in me, and that my parents birthed me out of that place of being people who actually push against the darkness and the despair instead of giving into it. I love that. And then we have these examples all around us of people, of archegoses of hope. We have the Mandelas of the world. We have the MLKs of the world. We have the Malalas of the world. Young people who just are those people who, instead of cowering under the decks of fear, they're actually pushing against the fear and the despair as defiance, an act of defiance. Archegoses of hope all around us. I think about the birth of Love 146. Those of you that know the story, I was in an undercover investigation 15 years ago in a brothel, looking through these glass windows at kids who had their lights just shut out because of the abuse that they were experiencing night after night, sold like commodities. And that one girl who stuck out because she was the only one that hadn't shut down yet. She had this fight in her eyes, this look of defiance, almost as if she was saying, you may take my body, but you will never take who I am. And that number on her that we remember to this day, 146, she stuck out at us because of that sense of defiance in her eyes, that pushing against, I will not give in to the realities of what is happening around me, but I insist on change. So we were birthed out of encounter with a person of defiant hope. When I think of defiant hope, I think of even my own children. One of my daughters, I want to go to the next slide here. When we were in Vietnam 8 years ago, adopting our youngest daughter, when she first, we had to stay there for 3 weeks to go through all the process in Vietnam and everything, and I found that she was doing something interesting at night. We were staying in a hotel at the time, and at night what she would do is we would take our shoes off and put them in the doorway of the hotel room, and at night when we would go to sleep and everything, the next morning I would come and I would find this in front of the door, that in the middle of the night, she would sneak out of bed, and she would take her little shoes and put them in my shoes as this signal of, like, I am not going to be left alone again. I'm not going to be forgotten again. She was insisting to make sure that we would not leave without her. She had been left too many times. She was forgotten too many times. She came to a place in her life of, like, this, it was her act of defiance of, like, I could just see her in the middle of the night, like, you're not leaving without me, man. I am not going to be forgotten. So even in my child at that time, who was considered an orphan, had that title put on her was a little child of defiant hope. There's a sense of aggressiveness there that's powerful and beautiful. And I think about the children in our care. We're learning the sense of defiant hope even from them. I mean, these kids wake up every morning, and you would think that, man, these kids probably shouldn't even have a reason to smile again, but they do. They laugh. They dance. They're full of joy. People that meet them are like surprised. I remember one person in particular in one of our safe homes that they came to visit, and they were at the end of the day, they were like, "Rob, I'm so confused. These are just like real children." And I'm like, yeah, because they are real children. And every single day they wake up in the morning and they choose to live another day. They choose aggressively to take their childhoods back and aggressively taking their lives back. That is defiant hope. So we have these examples even of children who are examples of defiant hope in our lives. In fact, last year I was at our safe home and we were having this little celebration. We always have like a dance party at the end of the night because the kids love to dance. And one of the caregivers in the home had this sound system. She puts on the sound system. The first song she puts on is "Watch Me Whip, Watch Me Nay Nay." And these kids just jumped out of their seats, and they are just dancing their hearts out all over the dance floor and stuff. And I'm sitting there, and I'm stunned. I actually had to sit down. I was so stunned by this celebration that was taking place, the joy that was actually palpable in this place as these kids were just dancing. And I, as I was sitting there, like, observing and stunned by the whole thing, one of our younger girls, she's 5 years old, She stops on the dance floor from dancing because she sees me sitting in my chair. And she has this look in her eyes, and I recognize it immediately, almost as if, this is not going to do, you just sitting in your chair. So she makes a beeline across the dance floor from me. She grabs me by the hands, pulls me out on the dance floor. And you guys, I whipped and I nay-nayed like there was no tomorrow. Because that's what you do when the defiantly hopeful ask you to join in their hope. And so we're learning that from our kids. And then, man, I think about even the youngest child that we had ever brought into our care last year. 1 year old. She was exploited and sold for a cyber porn ring by a family member. I'm holding a baby in my arms and recognizing what has happened to this little one. The horrors that have been committed, the injustice that is committed against this little one. And I'm just weeping, holding this baby. And after a while, she started getting antsy and started to cry a little bit and everything. And one of the older girls in our care came over and she took the baby from me. And then another one of the girls came over and another one of the girls. And I stepped away and I watched all of these other kids just surround this baby. And this hope began to rise in me again. As I thought, look at these archegoses of hope. For this little baby, one day when she begins to struggle with the realities of what happened and everything, she has these examples in her own life, these that have gathered around her, literally, that have tied the rope around their own waist and are immersed and swimming and making a way of hope for her that gives this sense of defiance against the despair. And then I think of the greatest archegos of hope that we could possibly imagine, the Son of God. If there was ever an example of defiant hope, we have it in the person of Jesus. In Acts chapter 3, verse 15, really interesting passage. It was after Peter and John. Do you remember this whole scene where there was the beggar asking for money, and they were like, "Man, I don't have anything on me, but what I give to you, I'll give to you in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Rise up and walk," and the beggar is healed. Remember that whole story and everything, right? And then what happens? A crowd gathers around because, like, what just happened? This is unbelievable. And as soon as a crowd gathered around, Peter had this thing like, "I'm going to go for it. I'm going to take advantage of this." So he just starts to go for it, and he starts to preach, and he says this in verse 15. He looks at this crowd, and he says, "You killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead, and we are witnesses of this." You want to hear the craziest, most beautiful thing ever? The word "author," and when he says you are the author of life, is translated in the original Greek, archegos. The word archegos shows up in the Bible four times. This is just crazy to me. This example, this visual of the archegos on the ancient mariner, that position of, man, you may be cowering under the decks of the ship. You may be faced with fear and despair. I'm going to make a way of hope to a place called home. And this picture now translated to Jesus. Here's Peter saying, he is the archegos of life. And he goes on in Acts chapter 5, 31. Again, Peter taking advantage of a crowd that's gathering. He's saying, God exalted him to his own right hand as prince and savior. The word prince is the word archegos in Greek. And in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10, many of us know these passages by heart. It was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through what he suffered. The word pioneer is the word archegos. And in Hebrews 12, the fourth time that you see the word archegos in the Word of God says this, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the archegos and perfecter of faith. Jesus, the author of life, the trailblazer of hope, the captain of our salvation. O captain, my captain, we have the ultimate archegos of life as our example. And I don't think it's enough for us to be content in just resting in the fact that we have an archegos that's gone before us. I think we're called to be the same for others. Can you imagine if we were not those like the Chicken Littles of the world that gave into fear and despair, but aggressively begin to be the people of defiant hope? Imagine if we took on that role of archegoses of hope for those around us, what could potentially happen, that we would lead the way for those who have been shipwrecked. I want to close with this from Rebecca Solnit, who writes beautifully about this kind of hope. She says, hope is to gamble. It's to bet on the future, on your desires, on the possibility that an open heart and uncertainty is better than gloom and safety. Oh, man, you guys, the safety thing. An open heart and uncertainty is better than gloom and safety. To hope is dangerous, and yet it is the opposite of fear, for to live is to risk. I say all this to you because hope is not like a lottery ticket that you can sit on the sofa and clutch feeling lucky. I say this because hope is an axe that you break down doors with in an emergency, and hope should shove you out the door. Hope just means another world might be possible, not promised, not guaranteed. Hope calls for action, and action is impossible without hope. The work of hope requires people who throw themselves, and I would add, throw themselves overboard, actively into what is becoming, to which they themselves belong. Anything can happen, and whether we act or not has everything to do with it. Could we stand together? I'm going to ask the worship team to come back. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe you've been shipwrecked by despair and hopelessness. You know, maybe you're in that place of, man, I identify with that psalmist. I'm waiting. The thing that I'm longing for doesn't seem to be coming past. Maybe you're overwhelmed by what looks like a strengthening and building storm. I want to encourage you to look to those who've gone before you. There are archegoses of hope all around us, and it's the call of God, I believe, on our lives. And if that doesn't work, look to Jesus, who is the author, the archegos of life, the archegos of hope, the trailblazer of hope, and the captain of our salvation. And as you close your eyes, I want to read the words to a song that we just sang earlier, and I didn't even know these guys were going to sing this song, but it's part of this whole thing. And as I read these, go along with it as almost as an ache and as a prayer and as a declaration. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. On Christ, the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. When darkness veils his lovely face, I rest on his unchanging grace. In every high and stormy gale, my anchor holds within the veil. His oath, his covenant, his blood supports me in the whelming flood. When all around my soul gives way, he then is all my hope and stay. Father, thank you that you sent your Son to be that archegos of hope, one that has gone before, one that has faced the madness and the mess of humanity and our sin, and dove in even as deep as the grave, and came out the other side with this lifeline called hope for us. Father, would you encourage us with that understanding and that knowledge of this great archegos of heaven? And then, Father, would you challenge us to become the same for others all around us? In Jesus' name.